Hey everyone, it's Dr. Jordan here, and from everyone at Barbell Medicine, we want to say thank you for all of your support this year. Truly, we couldn't do what we do without you, so in the spirit of Thanksgiving and the holiday weekend, thank you so much. And with that in mind, I wanted to tell you about our biggest sale of the year going on this weekend only. From now through Monday, everything on the website is on sale. You can take 20% off our one-on-one coaching from some of the most experienced coaches in the game. We only do this once a year, so if you're on the fence about working with a professional coach, there's no better time than now. Outside of coaching, our training templates, whey protein, PeriRx supplement, and our freshly restocked apparel are all marked down 20% as well. We're even discounting our Barbell Medicine Plus membership for a limited time only, so you can get ad-free listening, exclusive content, and support what we do here at Barbell Medicine for up to 30% off. Head over to barbellmedicine.com/shop and check it out. You can stock up on gifts for your favorite workout enthusiast with special deals on coaching, apparel, templates, supplements, and more. That's barbellmedicine.com/shop. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone, and thanks again. Hi, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, founder of Barbell Medicine, and over the last 10-plus years in business, we've built a team of amazing professionals that includes physicians, physical therapists, dietitians, and strength coaches that are available to help you reach your goals. Whether it's strength and muscle gain, weight management, or recovering from an injury, we have some of the best coaches in the game and have worked with people from all walks of life. From teens to grandparents and beginners to elite-level athletes, our experienced team of professionals work together to meet you where you're at and give you what you need to succeed. That's the Barbell Medicine difference. If you're not sure exactly what you need, take the quiz linked in the description below or send us an email, support@barbellmedicine.com, and we'll get you sorted. From all of us here at Barbell Medicine, we look forward to hearing from you. We'd love to help. Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. This is Teaching Rounds, Osteoarthritis Edition. This is actually the very first podcast that we did, Dr. Baraki, the second most handsome doctor in North America. This is the first podcast we did 7 years ago. Can you believe
it? Yeah, bringing it around. I think we're older, wiser, and hopefully able to give better quality advice these days.
Absolutely. Yeah. So what are teaching rounds? Well, in the hospital, you do teaching rounds with your med students and residents and such as you're rounding on patients. You'll teach some stuff and occasionally happens in a more formal setting. But what we're doing here with teaching rounds, we're using that term to describe not only a review of topics we've covered before, but also updates and summaries, ideally in a more digestible and accessible format. Can't tell people, yeah, just search our podcast library for X topic. And osteoarthritis is very, very important, as we'll see in this particular edition of Teaching Rounds. So we're going back to the beginning and highlighting some updates, highlighting some new information. And these are episodes that after the start of the new year, so 2025 rolls around, this will be on our Barbell Medicine Plus, are available for our Barbell Medicine Plus members. And but we'll keep these on our main feed until that time has come. So Dr. Baraki, let's start out with the definition of osteoarthritis. What is osteoarthritis?
Yeah, so it's a very common condition. It describes a chronic disease that leads to symptoms like joint pain, joint stiffness. Sometimes people can experience limitations in their range of motion around that joint. Over long periods of time, the structure of the joint can change, leading to things like bony enlargement. And as a result, this leads to reductions in people's physical function and ultimately their quality of life.
So who even gets this though? Because when you talk about this, okay, chronic disease, that sort of implies like a long period of time, but joint pain, I mean, people have that throughout the lifetime, right? And you can have limitations in range of motion, but who typically gets osteoarthritis?
Yeah, it's joint pain certainly can affect people of all ages, and there is a very large, broad, what we'll call differential diagnosis for joint pain. And joint pain can be acute or sudden onset, but that would not be the type of issue we're talking about here with osteoarthritis. This is a much more, as you mentioned, long-term issue. So as a result, it does become more common with age. A lot of people assume that it is normal to experience this as you get older, or that it is a necessarily inevitable part of aging. And those are not really accurate. That's not how I characterize it or discuss it with patients. Additionally, there's often a presumption that it will necessarily get worse, that it is always progressive, or that people will always end up needing surgery. And none of those things are correct either. In fact, about 9 out of 10 people with knee osteoarthritis can manage all right without ever needing joint replacement surgery. And I think that that proportion may be even a slightly higher than that if people do a great job working with a qualified clinician to follow a lot of the types of recommendations and advice that we'll lay out here today.
Yeah. Well, so why is it that knees are like the most commonly affected joint? You know, I've gotten questions before, particularly on various social media outlets. You know, why are shoulders so commonly injured in resistance training, or low back pain? Why is it so common with resistance training or even knee pain? And I'm like, well, those joints by and large are the most common joints to be injured for humans at large, regardless of activity level. But do you have any insight into why knees are like the most affected joint in those with osteoarthritis?
Yeah, knees are affected in over 80% of all cases, but osteoarthritis, or what is sometimes referred to as OA, can also involve other joints like the hips and the hands, shoulders, all sorts of, including spinal, you know, vertebral joints and things like that. I don't know that we have a single simple explanation for this, because osteoarthritis is a complex, what we'll call multifactorial condition. A lot of different things lead to it. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but things like a history of joint trauma is one thing that can increase the risk of developing osteoarthritis down the line. So there are certainly things like injuries, traumas, mechanical factors involved in this condition, but there's also a lot of other issues that we'll get into relating to other aspects of biology, like obesity, inflammation, and then other aspects relating to people's kind of nervous system and how that relates to the experience of pain and coping and things like that.
Yeah. Okay. So let's move on. Let's talk about diagnosing OA or osteoarthritis. People probably assume that this is something, there's a lab test for this, or you could just take a picture, a fancy picture, the X-ray, CT, MRI of a particular joint or series of joints and say, oh, you got osteoarthritis. That's what's going on here. But it's more complex than that. So why don't you take people through kind of the diagnosis of osteoarthritis?
Yeah, and this might be surprising to folks. This is probably not their experience. For example, if they get referred to an orthopedist for this type of a concern, a lot of times people get referred and the doctor won't even see them if they haven't had, you know, pre-clinic x-rays and things like that, which if you're consulting with a surgeon for possible surgery, that's a different type of scenario. But in general, osteoarthritis, kind of common, quote unquote, or run-of-the-mill osteoarthritis can be diagnosed just based on a suggestive clinical history alone. So if I'm taking a history on somebody and they're telling me a story that fits with what I'll call my mental illness script for this condition, this fits the kind of the textbook, what I would expect, maybe middle-aged, maybe older person, some progressive gradual knee pain, some stiffness, usually worse at the end of the day than at the beginning of the day, things like that, then you can often make a clinical diagnosis of osteoarthritis without the need to pursue any sort of imaging. There is sometimes a role for imaging like X-ray or MRI, in particular, if you want to rule out an alternative cause of joint pain. If you're like, well, this could be osteoarthritis, but something about their story doesn't entirely fit. Or maybe I'm worried about an autoimmune condition cause of joint pain like rheumatoid arthritis, or maybe I'm worried about a fracture of you know, the bone around the area, or I'm worried about some other traumatic injury that would need to be remedied. Or alternatively, again, if surgery is being considered for surgical planning purposes. X-rays are very commonly done for this condition, both when they are necessary and when they are not necessary. And X-rays can show findings, for example, in knee X-rays, we can see things like narrowing of the joint space between the thigh bone, the femur, and the lower leg bones, like the tibia. There can be sclerosis and cysts that form in the heads of the joints that abut one another. Osteophytes are these little bony outgrowths that I mentioned at the outset, and then various other irregularities of the joint surfaces. But it is a lot more complicated to interpret the relevance and significance of these findings than just looking at the picture alone.
Yeah, that reminds me of some of my intern days where, you know, somebody would turn up to the primary care clinic and say, I've got this elbow pain, for example, or some joint pain, or even a pain in some area of the body. And if there's a bone there, you better believe they're getting an x-ray before they leave that office. It's sort of a CYA thing slash, again, making sure that you're not missing anything. But yeah, if you've listened to any of our mystery cases before when we talk about joint pain, you'll know that there are many different potential causes of joint pain, not just osteoarthritis, but certainly some other potential issues that people can have. So, all right, with that in mind, we've got a definition, we've got a diagnosis. Now let's talk about what actually causes osteoarthritis. And something, if you're in the lifting community and somebody else potentially who has osteoarthritis or otherwise has joint pain, they see you lifting something heavy, invariably they're going to say something like, you're going to pay for that when you're older, you know, because it's just wear and tear. Yeah. Wear and tear on the joints. You're simply a car. So also, where does that idea come from and how does that relate to osteoarthritis? Is it just wear and tear? Is that real?
Yeah. I mean, the idea, the story, that narrative makes sense to a lot of people. It, you know, they kind of have this conceptualization of aging as generally wearing out with time. This idea holds that the stress of, be it repeated bending or loading or use of the joints, will just wear it out until ultimately, well, just like a car part, needs to be swapped out and replaced with a new one. The assumption here that our body parts are like parts of a machine is not really complete. One of the fundamental differences that we try to emphasize in our messaging is that, unlike cars, machines, et cetera, our bodies and joints can actually adapt when they experience stress. Of course, that stress needs to be dosed appropriately. Shouldn't be too much, shouldn't be too little, but your car can't adapt. Your car's engine doesn't get bigger and stronger and faster the more you drive. I know that would be awesome for you to experience, or your motorcycle. The tires don't grow the more you ride your motorcycle, whereas we have all experienced our bodies adapting with appropriately dosed stress. Now, sometimes we experience some setbacks when that dose gets a little too high, and sometimes we atrophy a little bit when that dose gets a little too low. But over the course of the lifetime, that's one of the fundamental ideas here. But, you know, there is some underlying truth to, you know, some wear in the joint, but that's not the sole story. It's not an adequate explanation for this. And so what I mean is that one of the hallmark findings in a lot of joints with osteoarthritis, people experiencing osteoarthritis, is some cartilage loss in the joint. Cartilage is this smooth surface that's on the end of the bones, in between where the bones come together to form a joint. But osteoarthritis is not just a disease of cartilage. That is historically how it used to be thought of. It was just the severity of your osteoarthritis. We could just measure it in terms of how much cartilage you have. And over time, it gets worn and worn and worn away. And then you would hear this phrase over and over again, quote unquote, bone on bone. And that's a pretty catastrophic kind of thing to hear. Because then, you know, combined with the aches and the pains and the stiffness, and maybe you have a little crepitus or the snaps, crackles, and pops in the joints, and that scares you and you want to use your joint less and less. You become less active, your health declines, and then ultimately, you know, maybe if you're lucky, you might be a candidate for a joint replacement surgery at that point. But even then, it's not a guarantee that you're going to have a perfect outcome on the other side of that. We've updated our understanding nowadays and recognize that osteoarthritis is a condition that affects the entire joint, not just the cartilage, but the bones, the ligaments, the joint capsule or synovium, and all of the muscles around the joint are also impacted directly or indirectly by this condition. And as a result of all of that, it fundamentally has impacts on the entire person. And so rather than viewing it as just a cartilage problem, we view it as a problem of the whole joint, or indeed the whole person. And that is also reflected in the fact that there are so many other factors that can influence whether a joint becomes sensitive and painful than just how many millimeters of cartilage you have on the end of it.
Yeah. And I think that actually is interesting, because what you're describing again is this like holistic sort of view of not only the person, right, but also the condition that they're experiencing, rather than trying to find this, you know, reductionist root cause of osteoarthritis in this particular case. If it was just a condition due to cartilage, you could measure it, say, oh, you got this many millimeters. You might start thinking about supplements that would directly, theoretically target the cartilage or production of cartilage and so on. And so it's interesting, like when people kind of go down this rabbit hole, they can kind of wind up in completely different places. If you take this sort of whole person view or whole joint view, in particular for osteoarthritis, you end up in a decidedly different position and different narrative and your understanding of the disease is different than if you're like, it's just cartilage or it's just bone on bone or whatever. And that's going to influence subsequent behaviors, right? If you believe that it's bone on bone, if you believe that, well, look, the more and more I move it, the more wear and tear I'm going to have on this particular joint, the less cartilage I'm going to have or whatever. How do you get somebody to exercise after that, right? And I think some of the statistics around this are really interesting, where people who do have sort of this imaging or the x-rays or CTs or MRIs that are taken of the joints, they have findings that are consistent with what you would predict to be osteoarthritis, but they have no symptoms. They're asymptomatic. How common is that? We've talked about that with like low back pain and herniated discs, for example, that, you know, 40% of people over the age of 40 are going to have a herniated disc and they have asymptomatic, they don't have any symptoms, right? Well, what about in osteoarthritis? Is that a similar finding?
Yeah, it's a very similar finding. And there's not one statistic that I could give you, because this graded increase across the lifespan is pretty typical. So, you know, as it's almost like it follows the age in number in terms of the percentage likelihood that we would see radiographic findings like this on your imaging, independent of whether or not you have symptoms. And so that's kind of what I was alluding to earlier, is that the diagnosis is not one that you can make purely based on x-ray. I've seen some what you would call quote unquote horrific looking x-rays that look real bad, and the person's feeling fine and doing fine and has no complaints. And other ones where they had pretty debilitating symptoms and maybe it didn't look quite as bad. So there's a significant discordance there. But it's not a complete discordance. It's not completely unrelated. As I said, there is a role for structure and some, you know, underlying biology and mechanical factors here as well. So when those kind of studies are done, they're usually looking at, you know, widespread, you know, comparing people to other people and trying to correlate the severity of findings versus the symptoms that they report. There have been some interesting studies that have been done within people. So for example, looking at one person's, if they have osteoarthritis in one joint, looking at that joint versus the same joint on the other side of their body. So one knee versus the other, for example. And in that situation, which kind of helps to control for some of the confounders or the mediating variables, other things that can influence the pain experience between people within one person, one joint versus another, there actually does appear to be a little bit stronger of a relationship between the two. This was an interesting study by Dr. Niyogi in 2009, who is a major player in this world of osteoarthritis and rheumatology. And we can provide that study in the show notes because it was an interesting one to kind of temper your discussion around the idea that, like, what's the significance of imaging findings? It seems that population-wide, between people, varied. You can't look at a scan and predict whether somebody has pain or not. But to the point that there is some relevance of structure and function and things like that in the joints, between joints within the same person, there's a little bit of a stronger correlation. But ultimately, how do I communicate this with patients? This is a common framing that I'll provide when I'm having these conversations, just saying something as simple as two people can have the same changes on an X-ray, but they experience the effects very differently. And this helps to, you know, raise our confidence that there are other factors at play in your experience of pain. And this is actually a good thing because it gives us more potential things that we can work on. If it was just down to this one thing, well, that would be the only thing that we would have available to us to fix. And maybe that would necessitate surgery. But when there's a lot of different things that can impact pain, it means that we have a lot of different things that we can attack, intervene upon, act upon. I deliberately avoid ever using phrases like bone on bone, because as you said, when people hear that, they tie it to the experience of stiffness and the snaps, crackles, and pops and aches and pains. And they say, well, if it's already bone on bone, then moving around is going to make it worse. So I better not exercise. I better not bend it. I better not load it. I better not do anything with it. And that leads to progressive debility over time and worse outcomes.
Yeah. Yeah. So it seems like people, you know, if they have a particular understanding of osteoarthritis or OA that is very joint focused, it likely sends them down a path of not only worse sort of function, but ultimately like worse sort of symptom, like prolonged symptom duration, further detraining and disability in the future. So moving away from this sort of joint focused view of osteoarthritis and again to this whole joint, whole person sort of condition, do you have like a overall synopsis of like, what are all these contributing factors and like, how do you go about trying to like identify, well, these are levers we can pull to address these multiple factors?
Totally. Yeah. So looking at the person's health in general is really the first place I look, in addition to assessing for whether there was any prior traumatic injury. A few of the main factors that we think about is, has there been prior injury to that area? There can certainly be like genetic, hereditary type, you know, influences that are not terribly modifiable. So we don't spend a ton of time on that. And then the presence of other medical conditions, most importantly and most prevalently, would be things like excess body fat or carrying obesity. And so we know that there's a direct continuous relationship between obesity and osteoarthritis risk. You'll hear various statistics quoted in terms of, you know, correlations between a certain amount of weight gain and the risk of knee osteoarthritis, like 5 kilograms of weight gain might increase the risk of osteoarthritis by, you know, a third or something like that. Overweight status would double your risk of knee OA. Obesity would quadruple your risk of knee OA, for example. And while this is traditionally, you know, thought of through that same mechanical wear and tear type lens of a lot of load goes through the joint, there you go. It's actually quite a lot more complex than that and is at least as much, if not more so, related to combination of some mechanical effects and also chronic inflammation of the whole body relating to the obese state where people have excess body fat, especially that visceral adipose around the belly that is very inflammatory. And that can contribute to all sorts of complications, health complications, like we've talked about, cardiovascular disease and high blood pressure, chronic kidney disease, things like that, in addition to musculoskeletal issues like sarcopenia, we've talked about loss of muscle mass, as well as the loss of bone mass, and then the development of osteoarthritis as well.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, there are hundreds of other medical conditions associated with excess adiposity, excess body fat. And again, some of those are related to mechanical causes, you know, obstructive sleep apnea comes to mind initially. But that's usually not the entire story, especially when we're talking about a complex medical condition like osteoarthritis. Sure, excess mechanical loading, unlikely to be beneficial from a chronic state, particularly not during exercise and so on. But also, yes, the inflammatory situation, the metabolic situation underlying the person's internal milieu to channel our Claude Bernard physiology reference. Okay, so that gives people a sort of a look at like the biological sort of inputs here. But what about, I mean, there's got to be some psychological tie-ins here, right? What sort of risk factors are present there?
Tons. There's a lot of psychological variables, social variables that come from interacting with one another and hearing things that are either helpful or unhelpful, and environmental factors. So one important one, for example, is poor sleep. Having poor sleep can increase pain intensity, and worsen people's debility or a disability relating to persistent pain related issues. And again, as I mentioned, with things that we learn from other people, worst of all from clinicians or those who we hold in a high position of authority on something and might be more inclined to trust on something, having negative beliefs about this condition. If you come to believe that, yes, it's just worn out, it's bone on bone, it's inexorably progressive, you're going to end up needing surgery, or maybe even worse, it's like they're saying something like that, but then, but unfortunately, you're not a good candidate for surgery because of your other medical problems, so there's nothing that we can do for you, and you know, you can spiral. And so there's a strong relationship then with the development of things like depression, anxiety, decreased sense of control over your situation, which is, we've talked about before, is self-efficacy. Having a sense that you have a role to play in the management of your condition, that you have some control over it. It doesn't have to be all of it. You're not going to do your own knee replacement, but having some role to play and control and some influence that you can exert over your situation is super important as it relates to outcomes from persistent pain-related issues like osteoarthritis.
Yeah, well said. Okay, well, let's now that we've got a diagnosis, we've got a definition, we've kind of talked about the pathogenesis of osteoarthritis, let's start talking about some treatment here. We'll start with some non-pharmacological treatments. So we'll start with exercise. No surprise here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast, even on teaching rounds, we are big proponents of exercise for virtually all medical conditions. Seems to improve virtually all tissues, all organ systems, all health-related trajectories. No surprise, exercise is beneficial. But specifically for osteoarthritis, this seems like a very powerful tool that we have at our disposal, which is kind of juxtaposed against this narrative that, like, well, if it's bone on bone, wear and tear, chronic degeneration, you probably shouldn't exercise. So, like, how do you square that? Like, if we know that exercise is such a powerful tool, and you'll cover some of the evidence on this, how do we square that with the sort of messaging that's been going on for decades, if not millennia on some level, because this has been a problem for a long time?
Yeah, it's really important to communicate very carefully in these situations. And ideally, you can establish some trust and rapport with your patient or your client so that when you try to do this communication that they're inclined to buy in and not to say you're crazy because everyone else says you're wrong or something like that. But we know that generally physical inactivity or a lack of sufficient regular physical activity is a major risk factor for declines in function, for, you know, progression of this condition. So it becomes a really important target for us to work on to mitigate that progression, to try to reduce the risk that people get debilitated, disabled enough, or have such severe symptoms that they end up needing something like a joint replacement, because that is a relatively major surgery. And so even in patients who have what is diagnosed as advanced osteoarthritis by various clinical kind of criteria, if we can get them into effective exercise programs, kind of what is sometimes termed like prehab, rehabilitation, potentially prior to undergoing a surgery, but doing that ultimately resulted in this particular cohort that was researched, 75% of them ultimately declining to undergo that procedure at 12 months. And so for those who were, you know, had advanced osteoarthritis and were deemed eligible, like, hey, yeah, you'd be reasonable to get surgery, put them on this program. Well, then 3/4 of them at a year are like, nah, I don't need it anymore. And that very high proportion of people continue to not needing it over time. There's certainly some degree of crossover and things like that, but that's a huge, a huge benefit for a low cost, low risk, very safe intervention that also, I should say, has tons of benefits for all sorts of other health-related outcomes. It's not just helping their joint, their knee pain, and reducing the risk of surgery. It's improving their blood sugar, their blood pressure, their, you know, blood cholesterol, their weight management, their, you know, maybe their mood, maybe their sleep, all the other benefits of exercise that are tied in with this as well. And so when we can get patients doing appropriately dosed exercise, and I'm going to heavily caveat that, appropriately dosed exercise for the person, it improves the function of all of the structures of the joint. Again, we're not just trying to do something to fix their cartilage here. We're trying to work on the surrounding muscles and the joint capsule and the joint itself. And the whole person is who benefits from this, ultimately leading to desensitization in terms of pain over time and reducing that inflammation that could be going on very likely from carrying a little excess body fat. And again, improving aspects of health outside the joint as well. So ultimately, that's the goal that we want to get people to. And so the communication strategy is where the hard part is. You've talked about this before a ton, that what would be a major, you know, target for you if you were to be in charge of various medical curricula or coaching curricula, it would really have to do with the behavior change skills and the conversations and the communication abilities around these things. So I emphasize that it is safe to exercise, even if there's some joint soreness. We just need to find the right type and amount of activity to start for that person. And so I'll be inclined to, you know, maybe on day one, find something that is going to undershoot their amount of activity tolerance rather than overshoot it, so we don't immediately run into a setback. But just like when we're talking about pain and rehab situations, I'm trying to find an entry point for the person. And I'm trying to plant little seeds in their mind, like the phrase motion is lotion, to try to counteract the phrase, you know, bone on bone, if that's what's going on in there. So, and then the last thing I'll caveat and say here is I explicitly avoid talking about using particular activity modifications as a way to reduce load through the joint. In other words, sometimes people will say, oh, let's modify the activity to do this so that there's less joint loading, because you're implicitly delivering the same narrative when you say that to the idea that we should be sparing the joints from load, from stress, from stimulus, which ties into their concerns of, should I be exercising? Am I just going to wear it out more? So even if I am actually using strategies to offload it at the start, just to get them moving with a lower risk of you know, flaring up some symptoms while I find that entry point, even if I'm doing it in my mind, I'm not telling or saying, hey, we should really aim to reduce the load on this joint, because my goal over time is certainly to load the area. I just want to get some positive momentum and some trust in that process going before we get there.
Yeah. Having worked with a number of people with osteoarthritis, now granted, the pool of folks that I've worked with personally has been rather expansive, running the gamut from a person who does not currently exercise at all to, you know, fairly high level trainees. And so the high level trainee is going to have a better understanding of like what you're doing with when it comes to like exercise or physical activity modification. They're like, well, why am I doing higher reps now and tempo stuff and whatever? It's like, well, yeah, we're trying to sort of maybe back off some of the intensity that we were doing before. If you want to call it load reduction, that's not the phrase I would use, but more so I'm trying to find a place where you're not sensitive in a particular position or doing a particular task. But the vast majority of people with osteoarthritis are not highly active individuals, right? You think about the general population at large, most people don't exercise, and those with OA have even lower likelihood that they are meeting the current physical activity guidelines and doing some sort of resistance training, for example. So instead of framing it like, oh, we're trying to reduce load through the joints, right? Or like we're trying to find exercises that you're able to currently tolerate at a lighter weight, anything like that. I more frame it as sort of this graded exposure. We're trying to find stuff that you can do right now because of all the benefits of exercise. And we're hedging our bets that it will likely improve your function and ability to participate in all the things that you want to do anyway. What's the thing that you want to get back to doing most that you haven't been able to do for the last few years, for example? What sort of activity or sport or whatever would you like to participate in? Well, you're going to have to do X, Y, and Z, and so here's where we start. And so framing it that way is like desensitization, moving towards the ability to have less restrictions about what you can and can't do, I think is more powerful than talking about, we're reducing the load, or we're talking about net joint moments or torque or whatever. All that stuff, in addition to people not really understanding it, I think is ultimately unhelpful, because again, as you said, it's the same message, like reduce the stress on the joint. It's like, I don't know that I want to do that. In fact, you could make a case that some of the sort of treatment benefit of exercise is actually improving tolerance to sort of like a mechanical stress that we see with the physical activity. All right. Moving on to the next sort of non-pharmacological treatment for osteoarthritis. And actually, this is going to tie into some of the pharmaceutical sort of options that we have. Weight management. Now, you cited some nice statistic that, you know, as the excess adiposity, excess body fat increases, well, so does the risk of developing osteoarthritis. If it's an individual with overweight, their risk doubles. If it's an individual with obesity, it quadruples. So it makes sense then that weight loss, particularly body fat loss, can improve somebody's osteoarthritis, their pain symptoms, and their functionality. So this kind of goes back to all the things we've talked about with nutrition before. So yeah, you can do it through lifestyle alone. So that's diet, exercise, sleep, et cetera, plus or minus medication if needed, plus or minus metabolic bariatric surgery if needed. So how do you sort of conceptualize this to folks? Because again, their understanding is likely wear and tear. That's it, just less weight. So of course I would feel better. Do you go down the rabbit hole and start talking about inflammation or the innate immune system response or anything like that? Or you just kind of leave it as saying, I think weight loss would be beneficial for you this condition?
Yeah, I think that's a more individualized conversation depending on how much the person wants to geek out on this stuff. If they are motivated to lose weight and that is the way that they are motivated to do so because they are like, well, if I can get a bit less weight on this joint, then as long as I can still maintain their other buy-in to getting active and exercising, then fine, I'll let them roll with that. But if they're more curious, if they want to know more, then sure, we can get into that. But ultimately, my goal is to get buy-in into the, weight management or body fat management process. And so I suspect that, as we're doing these teaching round podcasts, we'll have multiple episodes in the near or medium term that are covering all the stuff we've talked about as it relates to obesity from a lifestyle, pharmaceutical, medical management, and surgical perspective. So we're not going to get into all the weeds on those here today. But that's weight loss via any of these mechanisms have pretty substantial effects on improving the symptoms and outcomes of osteoarthritis, whether you just are going to have the condition, your ability to manage it, or if you have it and maybe you're going to be undergoing surgery, you're going to have better outcomes perioperatively, postoperatively, if you've managed to lose some weight beforehand as well.
Hey everyone, I hope that you're enjoying the podcast. I just wanted to remind you that we have launched our Barbell Medicine Plus option in order to help support what we do here on the podcast and beyond. Now, Plus members get early access to our podcast, ad-free listening, written transcripts and summaries, videos, exclusive access to a members-only podcast where Dr. Baraki and I answer your questions directly, and more exclusive content as well. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus. And just think, no more of these ads. Thanks for your support. Now back to the podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. As we gather with loved ones this Thanksgiving, consider how learning a new language can enhance your connections and enrich your experiences. You guys know I've been trying to learn French using a competitor, Babbel, before I was endorsing Rosetta Stone. And while I had a good experience with Babbel getting ready for my trip to France, Rosetta Stone offers 12 more languages than Babbel, including many Asian languages that Babbel does not. Additionally, Rosetta Stone is offering 50% off a lifetime membership, which is an incredible deal. Now, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program for 30 years, with millions of users and 25 languages offered. It's also available on desktop or as an app, so you can learn anytime, anywhere. And it uses an immersive experience to help you learn the language of your choice, along with the correct accent, using its true accent speech recognition technology. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Barbell Medicine listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off by visiting rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life by redeeming 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
This podcast is sponsored by Incogni. Anyone who's been on the internet knows that online privacy and data protection is a big problem. Every year, both the number and severity of personal data compromise goes up. And according to the 2022 annual data breach report by Identity Theft Resource Center, the number of victims has gone up by nearly 41.5% from 2021. In the US in particular, there's a big problem where people search individual websites to create detailed personal profiles on millions of Americans and publish them online for anyone to see. The bad news is that your personal information is probably being sold or published online without you even knowing it. The good news is you have the right to protect your privacy and request that data brokers delete the information that they hold about you. Let Incogni do the work for you. Incogni reaches out to data brokers on your behalf, requests your personal data removal, and deals with any objections from their side. It's easy to sign up, and once you do, the entire process is automated. Incogni also keeps you updated about the progress. They're also offering Barbell Medicine listeners a promotional rate to get started. Use promo code Barbell at the link incogni.com/barbell to get an exclusive 60% off an annual plan. That's incogni.com/barbell to get 60% off your annual plan to protect your privacy. Go incognito with Incogni.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Yeah, there's also some maybe indirect and certainly direct sort of mechanisms by which weight loss can be helpful. So one, we know that one of the biggest barriers to people exercising, if they otherwise have access and opportunity to do so, is that individuals with overweight and obesity, they tend to exercise less. There's some sort of stigma there. So weight loss may encourage somebody to become more active, whether they do that simultaneously or they lose some weight and then ultimately feel more comfortable exercising. So that's thing one, because we know exercise is a big lever to pull. Also, just changing the dietary pattern in general, even if it doesn't produce a huge amount of weight loss, if it's just lifestyle alone, that's kind of our expectation for most folks. There is some thought that, you know, if you move to a more health-promoting dietary pattern from the standard American diet, the standard American diet is heavily processed, low in fiber, low in fruits and vegetables, whole grains, etc. It's, you guys see what people eat on a daily basis. That's the standard American diet. Those are not the dietary guidelines. No one's recommending that. But as people move to a more minimally processed, unprocessed dietary pattern, rich in lean protein, fruits, vegetables, et cetera, higher fiber, yeah, it's lower on this sort of diet-related inflammation. We've done an episode on diet-induced inflammation. And while I don't think that's a major mechanism for like reducing osteoarthritis and symptoms from osteoarthritis, I think it can only help. You know,
yeah,
to the extent like, oh, your C-reactive protein or whatever goes down a little bit. I don't know that's a huge mechanism, but it's not nothing. And yeah. I suspect it's overall helpful, especially if it does also reduce some weight loss in individuals who are carrying excess body fat. The next sort of non-pharmaceutical treatment that we have here, particularly for those who are going to be engaging in resistance training or otherwise sort of ground-based exercise, are knee sleeves. Now, no real conflict of interest. We've sort of absolved ourselves from any relationship with anybody who makes knee sleeves. But knee sleeves can be useful. And in fact, when you look at knee braces and knee sleeves and you look at the evidence that supports their sort of use in exercise, a lot of the data is actually in individuals with osteoarthritis of the knee. And almost universally, you see not only improved ability to participate in exercise, but also improved performance in the exercise and reduce pain symptoms. And so that's like the holy trinity in my estimation. Like whatever you can do to get people more active, like, yeah, almost sign me up for just about anything, I think. And then further, if people are able to train in a more productive way, meaning that they can get stronger, for example, they can gain some more muscle mass, they can increase their VO2 max from cardiorespiratory fitness training, well, that's going to improve their health otherwise, even separate from this, even further on average. So I think all of those things make a good use case for knee sleeves. I'll say this, though. My father, he's had one of his knees replaced, all right, and he's got osteoarthritis of the other knee. And, you know, when I take him to the gym and we work out a little bit together, I got him some knee sleeves. Now, I didn't get him an SBD competition spec knee sleeve. Look, they're great for me. I don't have a problem putting them on. That's fine. But for him, he's not dragging that thing up his calf and dealing with all that. So I actually got him those blue – do you remember those blue Ray-Ban knee sleeves?
I still have a pair, yeah.
They're great. They're still 7 millimeters thick, so they're nice and warm. So they give people a little bit of security around the joint. They don't really store energy, but again, I think most of the mechanisms that have been purported for how knee sleeves work have to do with the sort of joint – position sense, also the feeling of more stability in the knee, and maybe some temperature, some sort of thermal sort of component there. But he can just pull them right on. And he just leaves them on his whole workout and happy as a clam. So, well, as happy as my father can be anyway.
That's, right. Yeah. And it's worth pointing out, you know, and there's also going to be a component of placebo to this as well, which is kind of impossible to placebo control or blind somebody to this if you're going to study it. But it is a low cost and no risk intervention, which is why it's a win-win, because there's no negative side effects of this. Assuming you're not buying the ultra tight ones and you choke off your lower leg.
Yeah. Well, so in fact, when they do like these sort of placebo type knee sleeve studies, they wear like a very loose knee sleeve, which they measure with a pressure transducer to say, oh, this is providing no, sort of support versus very tight ones. And there's no difference. Yeah. So there's really no reason from a pain perspective for most folks to get the tight one where you have to struggle to go on. And we do have a dedicated podcast and article on what do knee sleeves do. So if you're curious about that, linked in the description below. Last thing here, people are going to ask about, what about massage or dry needling or ultrasound or TENS or various other therapies, cupping, etc. Generally ineffective for osteoarthritis outside of some of these placebo-mediated mechanisms, these clinical theatrics, as we so call them. Like, look, you went into a specialist's office, they did this thing, right? And you expect that you're going to get better because of the heroics that your clinician undertook to treat you. I'm not saying that stuff is bad, but there's some risk there, particularly when you're putting needles in the body, for example, like with acupuncture or dry needling. And there's some cost involved. And then there's also some sort of like maybe narrative building that could be potentially harmful down the road. So for example, if you think that the osteoarthritis is due to like a tight muscle, for example, or due to something that needs to be released due to with the TENS unit or otherwise, that may be setting somebody down a path where they have this very joint-centric, mechanical, sort of centric view of osteoarthritis, which I don't know is a huge risk, but maybe no risk, certainly not no risk. I think I'd be comfortable saying that. Is that kind of how you think about these sort of complementary alternative sort of treatments?
For sure. They're nowhere near my top or even middle or arguably the bottom of my list of recommended things. Whereas if a patient seeks this out on their own and they want to go spend money and time on that, that's on them. Whereas I would more heavily emphasize the things that are much more clearly demonstrated to have efficacy for this.
Yeah. But if somebody like wants to go get a massage and they feel like that helps them exercise more frequently or with a greater sort of efficacy, great. Go for it. But, cool. You know, don't get a second mortgage on the house to afford some of these things.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it is the Barbell Medicine Podcast. So we got to talk about medicines a little bit. I think probably when most people are considering osteoarthritis and medications thereof, they're thinking about painkillers, whether it's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, like an NSAID, or even something stronger than that. Broadly speaking, Dr. Baraki, how do those work for managing pain secondary to osteoarthritis?
Yeah, so these medicines that we'll talk about, they all work via different mechanisms. So they work in all sorts of different ways. And as a result, they have variable effectiveness for treating the symptoms of osteoarthritis. The intent of them, typically when they're used, is to reduce pain symptoms and ideally to then facilitate physical activity. And so as with most other situations in practice where I'm prescribing medicines of any kind, I'm trying to use them at the lowest dose necessary and the shortest duration necessary to achieve that goal of, this person has a lot of pain symptoms that's limiting them from activity. I need to get control of those symptoms so that they can then participate in activity, in physical therapy, and whatever other activities we're trying to accomplish. Some patients are going to need continuous long-term use, in which case, again, I'm trying to use the safest option for them at the lowest dose necessary to achieve that goal. And then that's just part of how we think about prescribing medicines in practice. There are some good resources out there for the clinicians, for example, or if you're just an interested, you know, layperson or a coach who wants to get a sense of how effective are these medicines for this condition. There's a resource that we can also link. The website is just pain-calculator.com. Pain-calculator.com. It comes from some folks who I follow in Canada who basically compiled a lot of the best evidence for pain medicines in three different sets of pain conditions. One is neuropathic pain, which is outside the scope of today's talk, low back pain, and then in osteoarthritis. And so if you can select the osteoarthritis pain calculator, it shows you some nice data indicating how effective are any of these things for treating pain related to osteoarthritis. But to summarize, we're just going to go through a few of these medicines that are commonly used, prescribed, and I'll let you know what I think of them. So the first is topical medicine. So this is like gels and creams that you can put on the painful joint. Most commonly would be a topical NSAID, topical non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug like diclofenac, sometimes branded Voltaren. I'm sure it's branded a lot of other things around the world. This is actually a very good option for people. It has a low risk of systemic side effects because it's just absorbed locally and minimal absorption to the rest of your body. It's been shown to be safe. It's superior to placebo for treating knee osteoarthritis pain as one example. And it's comparable in terms of how effective it is to oral NSAIDs for that condition. It is thought to be a bit less effective for less superficial joints. So what do I mean by that? The knee, you can see it. It's right there, right? But for other joints where there's a lot of soft tissue over it, so like the hip joint, which is under a thick butt muscle, ideally, if you've been doing your training, then the thought is that that medicine is going to have a little bit of a tougher time penetrating down to the level. However, interestingly, the response to topical placebos when they've done these randomized studies is about twice that of the response to oral placebo pills when compared with oral NSAIDs versus topical NSAIDs. So there is something to the idea of just like, well, I'm putting it right where it hurts. And so maybe that placebos you a little bit more. So I like using topical NSAIDs for these more superficial joints. Mainly this ends up being things like the knees and the hands. I don't typically go to it as much for other joints like the hips, the shoulders, the back, things like that, although it wouldn't be wrong or harmful or dangerous to try it if you wanted to. Topical capsaicin is another one that's sometimes used. I've rarely found patients who love the use of topical capsaicin. That's the stuff that makes hot peppers hot, and it has some effects on the function of the nerves that mediate what we call nociception or kind of the pain experience. Yeah, that's it for topicals. Do you have any? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, just a comment on topical capsaicin. Having used topical capsaicin a number of times when I've had some knee pain, I don't know why, like how I got down this rabbit hole initially. I mean, we're talking about over 10 years ago.
Yeah.
The problem with topical capsaicin is that it tends to go places you don't want it to go. And I'm just going to leave it at that. And overall, 0 out of 10 would not recommend, generally speaking. I don't like the feeling of my skin kind of burning, and particularly in those areas where I did not actually apply said capsaicin. So I'll just leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you. I'll assume you're talking about like putting contact lenses in, but people's imagination can go elsewhere. Sure.
It's fine. So, on the show.
There you go. So the next medicine I'll talk about is oral acetaminophen or paracetamol, or what is commonly known as Tylenol. Very commonly used for osteoarthritis. Barely any better than placebo, not thought to be terribly effective, but it's used a lot because it's super safe when you use it in the recommended dosage ranges. Very unsafe when you go above recommended dosage ranges, but it's used really commonly, even though not terribly effective. So I don't tend to use this a lot. Oral non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen or naproxen or meloxicam as just a few common examples are pretty effective for treating osteoarthritis-related pain, certainly more effective than Tylenol or acetaminophen. They do have a bit higher risk profile in terms of potential side effects affecting things like the gastrointestinal tract or the stomach, the kidneys, cardiovascular risk. However, one thing I wanted to point out, especially if we have clinicians listening in the audience, because I see this situation happen all the time. Patients with chronic kidney disease often receive just a blanket recommendation, well, you should never take NSAIDs again. This has been shown to have had an effect on more of them getting prescribed opioids instead, because opioids do not have a negative effect on the kidneys, or medicines like gabapentin or pregabalin, things like that, because they have no impact on kidney function. This is the result of exclusively focusing on a person's GFR, on their kidneys filtration, without paying any attention to all the other things that could be relevant here. I think that the risk of the use of NSAIDs at low to lower doses, for example, the risk of that is probably overblown in patients with stable chronic kidney disease and appears, based on some relatively recent data, to actually be safer than putting them on opioids instead, which is something I still see all the time. There's some data from the CRIC study, CRIC, in 2020 that basically looked at what's the effect of this, how many patients with chronic kidney disease end up getting transitioned to opioids or gabapentinoids instead, and that does not appear to be a nice story for them. So I, think that if somebody with chronic kidney disease is going to be using NSAIDs for the management of osteoarthritis, they certainly should be doing this in consultation and following with a physician. But I don't love the blanket, like, absolute, you should never take this again across all scenarios, because the trade-offs of opioids or gabapentins versus taking the low-dose NSAID that has maybe little to no effect on your kidney disease progression, but may facilitate your ability to exercise and get healthier. And that's far more important and potent of an effect. And on that note, opioids, gabapentin, pregabalin, I don't usually recommend these for patients with osteoarthritis in particular. The risks of these generally outweigh the benefits for the majority of patients.
Yeah. One just quick note on oral NSAIDs. So again, like ibuprofen, naproxen, et cetera, people will be listening to this and they say, well, did I hear something about, you know, ibuprofen? If you take it around the time that you exercise or before or after, it's going to compromise muscle protein synthesis. And like, shouldn't we be avoiding that? Like, look, yeah, we want people to exercise, but isn't it going to like maybe ruin their gains or something like that? And actually, it's interesting. The original research group who found this, that there was a decline in muscle protein synthesis in the hours after a workout if somebody took ibuprofen before or during exercise, they came back a few years later and said, yeah, so we looked longer term, like did these people have less hypertrophy results or less sort of strength improvement? And the answer was no. In fact, in the individuals who did have osteoarthritis, they actually had an increase in hypertrophy and an increase in muscular strength. And the thought there was, well, they were just able to train and exercise not only more, but also at a level that was conducive to actually making gains. So I don't think that ibuprofen is like anabolic, so to speak, but I think that if it helps people exercise, I am in favor of it.
Yeah. Yeah. The last couple things I'll mention are joint injections, which are commonly used, might be familiar to some of the audience. So steroid injections may provide some short-term pain relief, and they can be useful in patients with really severe symptoms, again, to facilitate physical activity and rehabilitation. I don't love the idea of they just have chronic joint pain, so they just come in and get, you know, joint injections 3, 4, 5, hopefully not more than that times a year, and then they don't do anything else in between. There are some risks of joint injections, like introducing infection into the joint, which is admittedly rare for the person who's doing it is trained and using proper technique. Putting steroids into the joint can actually have systemic effects, like increasing blood sugar levels in patients with diabetes. And it's been found that it can accelerate cartilage loss, depending on how frequently these joint injections are done. Again, we don't fully know the significance of this particular finding. And as I mentioned earlier, osteoarthritis is more complicated than just cartilage, but that's something I would prefer to not accelerate if I could avoid it. And then a couple other kinds of injections that are done, PRP and hyaluronic acid injections, sometimes known as quote-unquote visco-supplementation. These have minimal to no effect on osteoarthritis compared with placebo. And when it has been studied in publicly funded trials as opposed to industry funded, all the benefits, quote unquote, have been shown to be related to the placebo effect. So I don't typically recommend these. This is not going to stop anybody who wants it from getting it. But they're expensive placebos, basically.
Yeah, that was kind of my understanding. We did that episode with Dr. Eubanks as well. And he kind of related some of that. Now, again, when you're talking about the efficacy of PRP, for example, it needs to be for a specific condition and a specific outcome. So there's various data on different conditions, but when it comes to osteoarthritis, this seems to be pretty clear based on the currently available evidence.
Yep.
Cool. All right. Now it's update time. Update. We need to come up with some sort of jingle maybe because this was not in our original piece on osteoarthritis. And I don't believe it was in the article that we wrote about this either, but there's new evidence as recent as I believe it was this past month on GLP-1 receptor agonists. So some anti-obesity medications and their effects on osteoarthritis. Austin, you want to summarize the study and kind of like your thought about what does this mean for like future treatment of osteoarthritis?
Yeah, I mean, these medicines, we have just built a growing and growing evidence base on their effectiveness, not only for facilitating weight loss, but their benefits on all sorts of other conditions to include cardiovascular disease, chronic heart failure, chronic kidney disease, various other conditions. And now there's been a new randomized trial looking at these medicines in the context of osteoarthritis. So this was a little over a year, 68 weeks, double-blinded, randomized, placebo-controlled trial in patients with obesity who had at least moderate knee osteoarthritis, who received either semaglutide, what people know as Ozempic or Wegovy, versus placebo. And of course, they got counseling on physical activity and a reduced calorie diet, regardless of whether they got the semaglutide or placebo. And when they looked at the endpoints relating to not only change in body weight, but also some validated kind of pain and function scales that are used to assess osteoarthritis in particular, found a pretty substantial benefit, both, of course, in mean change in body weight from the start of the study all the way out to week 68, where the group that got the medicine lost almost 14% of their body weight compared with just 3% who were on placebo, and then a substantial effect on reducing the WOMAC pain score, which is again used in this particular context, where they decreased 41, almost 42 points on semaglutide versus 27 points on placebo. So again, as with any other intervention for the outcome of pain, there's some component of placebo, but clearly this outstripped that. Now, how much of this is purely related to facilitating weight loss? I'm sure you could do a statistical analysis to see how much of the benefit on pain and function was fully explained by the change in weight, such that you could say that, hey, if they lost weight by other means, would we expect the same reduction in pain if they did it through lifestyle, if they did it through metabolic bariatric surgery? But that's almost beside the point here, that hey, this gives us another tool to facilitate not only reductions in weight, but improvements in function and pain control in patients with at least moderate knee osteoarthritis.
Yeah, and further, even if it was just weight loss, which I don't suspect to be true, I guess if percentage pie, I'd say, okay, maybe 75% due to like weight loss and the subsequent metabolic effects of having less body fat, but also just the reduction in inflammation, which we tend to see, again, partly as a function of fat loss, but also just the medications themselves and how they work. Here's the thing, though. Even if it was just due to weight loss, 100% of that percentage pie, all due to weight loss, well, guess what is way better at driving weight loss in individuals with overweight or obesity? That would be GLP-1 receptor agonists and other anti-obesity medications compared to lifestyle alone. Now, again, Barbell Medicine Podcast, we are huge proponents of lifestyle change. And it's not a either or type of thing. It's like, por qué no los dos? Why not both? Let's do lifestyle change. And let's also support people with these medications, particularly if it works better and if it results in a more rapid sort of improvement of what we're targeting here. In this case, it's the cumulative effect of having exposure to excess body fat, the cumulative effect of having significant joint pain that's limiting not only people's mobility, but their ability to participate in exercise, which ultimately leads to other unintended consequences long term. And it's like, why have people just kind of suffer, dragging them through this whole process when we have other tools available? It doesn't make much sense to me.
Agree.
Yeah. What about metabolic bariatric surgery? Again, if weight loss is helpful, there's got to be some benefit from metabolic bariatric surgery here.
Absolutely. There sure is. And again, we'll talk about the details of that in a future Teaching Rounds episode. But patients with obesity should undergo comprehensive evaluation for their lifestyle aspects, for potential candidacy to use medicines to facilitate it, as well as candidacy for surgery as well. So for a clinician, I would use what we call a low threshold to refer for consultations, meaning you should be doing it probably more often than you are right now, at least for consultations, not necessarily sending people straight to the OR, but they should get these opinions and access to these resources as much as they can.
Yeah. And speaking of surgery, so if somebody, they're doing the lifestyle stuff, they're doing the non-pharmaceutical sort of interventions, and they're just not making progress that is commensurate with their sort of goals here, is surgery ever an option for folks with osteoarthritis? Because I think people, they view barbell medicine as like anti-surgery. We're just, look, conservative management. But I don't think that's accurate, especially in the case of osteoarthritis.
No, it's certainly not. And it's amusing if I don't know if I've ever been characterized as anti-surgery, because I am involved in the management of surgical patients all the time for various conditions. And so for appropriately selected patients, for those who kind of meet the criteria to undergo it, joint replacement surgery can be life-changing for people. I have a few patients that I'm managing, one who comes to mind who has bilateral hip osteoarthritis that's severely debilitating. And unfortunately, where she lives, she has relatively limited access to a surgeon who has been able to, offer a surgery for several months. So she's on the schedule to get it done, but just the waiting period has been agonizing. And I've been having to get kind of creative with some medical, approaches and trying to get some exercise strategies in play to try to prehab her as much as we can for surgery, but it's still really, really tough. And so I'm optimistic that on the other side of getting, unfortunately, both hips replaced, I think she's going to come out way better and feel much better on the other side of it. Now, the earlier we can intervene in this process, the earlier in life we can get people active and healthy and try to maintain that health over time. As I mentioned, the proportion of patients who we can prevent from needing to go down that route is pretty high, but there's still always a fraction who can stand to benefit from it. And so I don't hesitate to refer for those kind of consultations if I think it might be appropriate for them. But the bottom line here is, you're going to have the best outcomes from undergoing a joint replacement surgery the healthier you are going into surgery. So everything we've talked about so far still applies, still would do all of these things in anticipation of a potential joint replacement surgery if you want to have the best outcome you can, and then keep doing the rehab and exercise on the back end of it if you want to maintain the function, because that's the whole point of this, right? So sometimes we hear patients who've undergone a surgery and then the doctor tells them just like, no more squatting ever or something like that. And it's like, well, If you weren't going to be able to do the thing you wanted to do, then you should have just stayed on the couch. And why'd you get the surgery? Just, you know, take some OxyContin and your pain will go away, right? If we were doing this to, you know, help you improve the quality of your life and get you doing the things you want to do. And so we have helped rehab tons of people, past joint replacement surgery, gotten them back to if they wanted to lift, if they wanted to participate in other activities and sports. So, you're probably likely in the long term to be less limited than you might think after a surgery like that.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Let it be known, though, with Barbell Medicine, we drew a line in the sand. We are not anti-surgery when it fits, but definitely are supportive of other lifestyle and other interventions alongside of that as needed. All right, Dr. Baraki, we're going to welcome you to Dr. Baraki's Corner. This is the take-home message that you have for people on osteoarthritis here on Teaching Rounds, Osteoarthritis Edition. So why don't you wrap this up for folks? Give them a little bite-sized nugget of info to take home.
All right. So osteoarthritis is a condition characterized by chronic joint pain, stiffness, reduced range of motion, some bony changes and enlargement, and as a result, reduction in physical function and quality of life. It's not simply due to wear and tear or degeneration that is inevitable with aging, but it's far more complex, relating to some mechanical factors, things like prior traumatic injuries, genetics, inflammation, body weight, obesity, psychological factors, and many others. So we try to transition away from using a very joint-focused view of osteoarthritis and instead view it as a whole-person condition. It responds pretty well to lifestyle changes like exercise, weight management, sleep improvement, and the other variables we've talked about earlier. We do recommend graded exposure to exercise, appropriately dosed, building capacity over time, trying to get people moving in a lot of different ways. This includes both strength training and cardiorespiratory exercise, trying to get people working towards those physical activity guidelines depending on their tolerance. This involves other lifestyle changes like healthy dietary patterns and other methods of facilitating weight loss when that's appropriate, as we've talked about earlier. There are a variety of topical, meaning like creams and gels, as well as oral medicines that can be safe and effective for treating the pain symptoms and facilitating physical activity. There are other medicines that I would avoid, for example, opioids, gabapentin, pregabalin for the treatment of osteoarthritis whenever possible. Steroid injections into the joints can provide some short-term pain relief, again, to facilitate function. Ideally, we minimize the frequency of those if possible, whereas other types of injections like PRP, hyaluronic acid, are essentially expensive placebos and are not worthwhile, in my opinion. And the most recent evidence that we discussed shows that anti-obesity therapies like GLP-1 receptor agonists, as well as metabolic and bariatric surgery, are helpful not only to facilitate weight loss, but also improve pain and function in patients with osteoarthritis. And if you do all these things and you're still suffering, consulting with a surgeon for potential joint replacement surgery may be an excellent option to restore your quality of life. And so the last thing I'll say for patients who might be interested, but definitely to clinicians, one of my most strongly recommended resources on this topic is the Knee Osteoarthritis Australian Clinical Care Standard. I have previously cited their low back pain clinical care standard. I'm a big fan of the Aussies when it comes to persistent pain stuff, and these clinical care standard documents are fantastic at laying out the basics of these conditions, the management, and one of my favorite things that I have not seen in many other guidelines is they actually have little sections with coaching for clinicians on how to talk about some of these things with patients, what things to say, how to say it, and what not to say to avoid delivering some of the harmful messages that we've laid out in this podcast. Never seen that elsewhere, and really big fan of these documents for that purpose.
Oi, oi, oi. Yeah. Hey, look, shout out to our friends down in the South Pacific. You guys are crushing it. Love that. All right. Well, that is a wrap here on Teaching Rounds, Osteoarthritis Edition. Special thanks to Dr. Baraki for joining us here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Now, before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
Hey everyone, it's Dr. Jordan here, and from everyone at Barbell Medicine, we want to say thank you for all of your support this year. Truly, we couldn't do what we do without you, so in the spirit of Thanksgiving and the holiday weekend, thank you so much. And with that in mind, I wanted to tell you about our biggest sale of the year going on this weekend only. From now through Monday, everything on the website is on sale. You can take 20% off our one-on-one coaching from some of the most experienced coaches in the game. We only do this once a year, so if you are on the fence about working with a professional coach, there's no better time than now. Outside of coaching, our training templates, whey protein, PeriRx supplement, and our freshly restocked apparel are all marked down 20% as well. We're even discounting our Barbell Medicine Plus membership for a limited time only, so you can get ad-free listening, exclusive content, and support what we do here at Barbell Medicine for up to 30% off. Head over to barbellmedicine.com/shop and check it out. You can stock up on gifts for your favorite workout enthusiast with special deals on coaching, apparel, templates, supplements, and more. That's barbellmedicine.com/shop. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone, and thanks again.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.